Welcome to Creative Conversations. I'm Roger Humphrey. In this episode, I'm pleased to welcome the award-winning scholar, author, and violist, Edward Clorman. If you love Mozart and Bach, then this is right where you need to be for the next 30 minutes. Please join us as we talk about his book, Mozart's Music of Friends, and his new book about the unaccompanied cello suites by J.S. Bach. Hey, before we begin, please hit like, follow, and subscribe, and all the other buttons that you see down there. Also, leave a comment. I'm still trying to convince that goofy algorithm that people are actually paying attention. Thanks. And we are welcoming to the show violist and author and award-winning educator, Edward Clorman. Thank you so much for taking the time to come on. I really appreciate you being here.
Thank you for having me.
Oh, my pleasure. Definitely my pleasure. So you are a violist, which I've only actually interviewed one other violist, and a couple of months ago, Emily Brandenburg, who is a new addition to the Cassatt Quartet in New York, and she was wonderful. I love the instrument. You and I were talking just a moment ago off camera that I really, really love the instrument. There's a warmth there that I you don't hear. The violin is a magnificent instrument, but it doesn't quite have that warmth and that empathy, I guess would be a word that I would use for the viola. Is that the way you feel about it?
The viola, you know, I mean, a lot of our best known music is ensemble music, and often we're not sort of the leading part. So I might here be allying in a duet with the first violin, and then there I'm more with the cello, and a certain kind of listener might pay attention to me, but it's sort of a thing where you'd notice if it was missing, like an ensemble actor, same sort of thing.
Exactly. So what drew you to the viola? Was there a specific time that you can pinpoint?
Well, many, many, many violas have started on violin and switched to viola at a certain point, or some play both throughout their careers. For me, it was around when I got into high school. I got curious about the viola. I had a friend in high school who's now the principal violist of the San Francisco Symphony. His name is Jonathan Vinokur. I really enjoyed his playing and thought it could be interesting to work a little bit with his teacher with a different instrument. And that was when I had opportunity to start playing in chamber music, playing string quartets, and fell in love with everything the viola afforded me.
I think, number one, aside from the sound and being in love with the sound, I think the other thing is it's a good business decision. My guitar students, every once in a while I'd have one that decided they wanted to switch to bass, and I go, you'll get more gigs. everybody wants to be a flashy guitar player in the band, you know, and the bass player is the guy that they're always looking for somebody to cover that part.
It is a funny thing that people often choose their instrument when they're a kid, and it has such implications if you pursue it the rest of your life. But those sort of practical aspects, what kinds of playing you can do and what kinds of work or teaching opportunities there might be, probably aren't so much on your radar and probably shouldn't be when you're a child choosing an instrument for you, but it has big implications for your life in music for sure.
So, yeah, I love it. And I am... personally, a huge fan of chamber music, and I sort of gathered from what little bit of research that I did that you are too. That's kind of where you live mostly, is in the world of chamber music. Is that correct?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, certainly with the viola, there's a lot of interesting solo music. A lot of it is 20th and 21st century, and It's challenging, and we enjoy learning it. But boy, if I want to play music by Mozart or by Brahms or by Schubert, most of what there is for us is ensemble music, and it's such a rich repertoire. It also means I get to play with so many other wonderful people, play with them in different combinations, maybe someone I knew 10 years ago, now I'm seeing them again. Maybe someone played the first violin part in this piece the last time I knew them, and now they're playing the second violin part. So it just gives opportunities to play with wonderful people and to experience the music new, based on different combinations you put together, where you're playing, how you feel about it this time versus maybe 10 years ago, I had a different energy or a different perspective on the piece than might come to it with a different combination, a different time and place.
Do you have a preference of chamber versus like orchestral or ballet or any large ensemble like that?
Oh, yeah. I mean, It's been a while since I've played a lot in a symphony orchestra, but I really enjoy going to hear them. I mean, that's remarkable to hear 100 musicians together on stage and all the colors and the energy. I lived in Montreal the past 10 years, and some of the first people I met when I moved to the city were ballet dancers. So I've been invited a lot to go watch them perform in the ballet, and that's always a wonderful thing to see them moving and to hear them. Often it's music I know as a musician, but I haven't really gotten to know it as they do in the ballet setting. So it just happens that my own career has involved a lot of playing and teaching and writing about chamber music more.
Oh, I see. Okay. So I am, I think in part because the guitar is such a small instrument. I mean, you talk to people and you say that out loud and they don't realize, because they think electric guitar and it's a lot of things, but small ain't the word. And but with a classical guitar and nylon strings, it's a small and very intimate instrument. As much as I do love orchestral music and whether it's symphony or ballet or opera, any of that, and I do love it. I love the spectacle of it. Personally, I love the intimacy of chamber and the solo stuff and things like that. So, one of the things that I like about chamber music is, and I forget who said this, and you can probably fill me in, that it's like a conversation between four people. And I love being a part of that, and I also just love listening to it.
The famous quote about that is from the German author and philosopher Johann Goethe, and he was writing about he went to hear this concert of virtuoso violin music, but he wishes instead he'd gone to hear Beethoven string quartets because you hear in them a conversation among four sophisticated individuals who bring out the specific characters of their different instruments. So that's a very famous comparison, string quartets being compared to conversation.
Yeah, I love it. And being a part of that kind of a chamber, I've played solo stuff and solo concerts and chamber things for, gosh, my career. The solo stuff I like, but my personal attraction is to sit down with friends. It's the closest thing to a garage band that we get.
Absolutely.
Is to sit down with friends and okay, you take this part and I'll take that part. And sometimes it's kind of fun to mix and match and see what happens. It's a good time. I love it. I love the sound of it. I love the intimacy of it. I love just the camaraderie, the experience of it. It's great fun.
And a lot of audiences feel really drawn into that aspect too, that, they're so much closer to the musicians than they might be if they were at a symphony or an opera. So they can see us making eye contact or giving a subtle cue or leading the way we take time or this sort of thing. And they feel really connected to the music making because it's so close.
So now you've written a book on Mozart and his chamber works, or string quartets at least. Can we expand on that a little bit? Can you kind of fill us in on what's going on there?
Yeah, well, it picks up on what you were just talking about, the comparison between chamber music and conversation, or chamber music and social interplay. So the title of the book is Mozart's Music of Friends. Second half of the title, Social Interplay in the Chamber Works. So the book, the first half of it is, what is it we know about the history in the Enlightenment during Mozart's period of chamber music being played in salons, private settings, often in people's homes. Often, people getting together to play just for the enjoyment of playing together with or without anyone listening. If there were folks listening, that doesn't mean we should call it a concert or call them an audience necessarily. It might be more like a social gathering where there is music and the folks who are there are listening, but maybe they're also playing games or chatting, and the whole atmosphere was one of social interaction. The music was an occasion for friends to gather. So I try to think about what can we know about what those private settings were like? How might that have influenced how the music was composed? So is there a sense that the music itself composes a kind of stylized conversation or stylized camaraderie, or even sometimes rivalry. One instrument tries to surprise or outwit the other ones. So, I mean, in the case of Mozart, quite a lot of his chamber pieces were written for particular friends to play with him or for particular occasions. So you almost wonder if he's composing a little bit of their personalities or their interactions into the piece. An example would be, He when he moved to Vienna, he befriended Joseph Haydn, who was thought of as sort of like the father or the popularizer of the string quartet. Mozart was very impressed with Haydn's quartets, very influenced by them, and wanted to write string quartets that would delight but also impress Haydn. And so he wrote them for these particular occasions where they gathered to play them with Haydn in attendance. And surely that had something to do with how these pieces were composed. So that's a little bit what I'm trying to explore and see how much maybe there is some historical evidence that helps us unpack it. But then based on that historical evidence, we use our imagination to see how it's possible to read a kind of conversation or social interplay into these pieces.
Oh, that's it sounds fascinating. I'll have to pick that up. That's available, I'm sure, through Amazon or someplace like that. And so I will make it a point to put links for anybody who's interested. I'll put those in the comments below this, and so that people can find you. So.
Website. Even for folks who might not read the book, or if you want to see the website along the book, the website is mozartsmusicoffriends.com. And there you can find some videos where I recorded some of these pieces with friends of mine and animated them so that you can see the way I illustrate that kind of interplay among the instruments. You can see it in a video as you listen. And I've also pulled together a lot of images. So these might be paintings with titles like A Family Being Served Tea. And on one side of the painting, there's the tea, but on the other side, maybe there's people playing a piano duet or a violin and piano duet. So I've tried to kind of depict what some of these settings might have been like.
Oh, wonderful, wonderful. Thank you. So, and as we get into this, you have a new book coming out in September, I believe, on Bach and his six unaccompanied cello suites. And I think that's fascinating. That, I mean, 100 years ago, those were just kind of oddball little pieces that nobody paid much attention to, and they've gained a lot of traction in the last few decades. So what have you found about them? What prompted Bach to write six full-on suites for unaccompanied cello?
That is a surprisingly difficult question to answer, and that's partly why there's so much mystery around these pieces, even a few centuries after they were composed. It was very common in Bach's lifetime to compose pieces in sets of six. So, for the keyboard suites, there will be six English suites, six French suites. For solo violin, he wrote a set of six pieces, which is three sonatas and three partitas. So that was sort of a standard way of composing. And for Bach, often the idea was, over the course of six pieces, I'll try to show you everything that's possible in this genre and for this instrument. So all the different kinds of ways you can interpret what a suite for keyboard or for violin might be. It's sort of like with the well-tempered clavier, he wants to show every key you can compose in, every type of prelude, every type of fugue. So that's one way Bach thinks about. But quite a lot of music Bach composed, either it was for instruments he specialized in, which were organ, keyboard, and violin, or a piece he might have written for some particular other musician or some particular occasion, or that it was part of his job to write them, like to write the cantatas every week. Why cello suites? That's a difficult question to answer. Around the time he wrote them, he was working in the city of Köthen in Germany. There, this was the one time in his life that his job was not to write church music. So he was basically a court composer for the prince there. The prince was a great fan of music. He played the viola da gamba, among other instruments. So why might Bach not have written suites for unaccompanied viola da gamba, you might wonder? Because there's a whole tradition of writing unaccompanied gamba music. There was a tradition of writing unaccompanied violin music, but for one reason or another, he opted to write these six pieces for cello. And we don't know who might have been among the first people to play them. A lot of his students were curious about these pieces, made manuscript copies of them as a way of kind of studying them. Some of them who copied them, they didn't play the cello themselves, so they studied them as compositions or to play at the keyboard. But why did he write that is a difficult question to answer. Maybe at this point in Bach's career, he was branching out from keyboard music. So he was developing his violin playing. That's why he wrote the unaccompanied violin pieces. And maybe he thought cello was the appropriate companion instrument. It's the best speculation we could have.
It's I first became aware, excuse me, I wasn't aware of the, what do I want to say, the idea that the cello suites were that unusual when I was younger. I just never gave them a thought at all, to be honest. And somebody gifted me a set of albums of Pablo Casals playing the six cello suites, and for me it was jaw-dropping. In many ways, one of the things that I really liked was that I had always thought, like I think most people think of with the cello, is it just kind of a one note at a time kind of instrument, you know? And now all of a sudden we've got, suggested polyphony here arpeggiated chords and almost, well, yeah, I won't even say almost, but I mean, you've got full on counterpoint going on with this instrument, that's only supposed to be able to play one note at a time. And so I just absolutely love them.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. So there are the unaccompanied violin pieces by Bach, the unaccompanied cello, unaccompanied flute, and all of these pose the challenge of how do we imply melody, bass, harmony, counterpoint with, in some senses, more limited resources than you have on a keyboard or on an organ.
Right.
When Bach composes for solo violin, he composes quite a lot of chords. So the unaccompanied violin pieces, they have these fugues that are very difficult to play because there's all these 3 and 4 note chords. When he writes for solo cello, there aren't nearly so many chords. So he even writes a fugue for solo cello that has a handful of double stops, a handful of chords, but it's mostly one note at a time. So you have to think, how can that be a fugue? How can we imply or give the impression, the kind of lives in the head of a listener, of many voices interacting in counterpoint? I think it's a real compositional challenge to write idiomatically for this instrument without making great recourse to chordal writing. You're absolutely right about that.
Yeah, I find it fascinating. I play a couple of the movements. Everybody, of course, like everybody, I play the prelude from the first suite, But it's such a great piece of music. For anybody who's listening to this and have never heard it, you got to listen to it. I think it's probably one of the most optimistic pieces of music in our repertoire. It is the ending of that thing is just like. It reminds me, the ending of that reminds me of the opening scene to the movie Sound of Music. It's just this ta-da kind of, it's just glorious. I love it. And yet, a couple of weeks ago, I was sight reading through the Sarabande from the second, and talk about 180 degrees apart. I mean, it is sullen, it is sad. It's like, wow, it's dark. And fortunately, it's not real long because otherwise you need therapy if you stayed with it for very long.
But yeah, over the course of the six suites, it's a kind of a journey because they take you through all the different characters and all the different possibilities. I know what you mean with the prelude to the first suite. It starts in kind of a medium register, and then by the end of the piece, it rises all the way up to the highest register, and it's just like the sun comes up. I've learned that on the web, if you search quote unquote that cello song. So people say, "Oh, where is that cello song?" Or, "Why is that cello song?" And all the that's what people mean is the prelude to the first cello suite. And they're right; it's used in many, many, many movies. It's used in Master and Commander to represent the sea. It's used in some very silly movies like The Hangover 2. There's this wedding scene where there's someone in the corner playing it. It's a really ubiquitous piece in popular culture and seems to connect with a lot of people for sure.
I think for me, I connect with it because for a variety of reasons. I think the guitar and the cello are very closely related in a lot of ways. I mean, sonority and pitch and range, for example, are all very similar. And the thing that I like about playing cello music, and any of that particularly, is it forces me to think like a chamber musician because I have these different voices, and I have the guitar has a capability of creating different timbres, and so I have to think like I'm arranging it almost for like chamber music. Do I, am I going to play it like this, or am I going to play it like that? And it's for me, I have to think very orchestrally on a piece that's written for a solo Oh, cello. And but I find that my it forces me to think about how my lines are going to run. So am I going to play this note here, or I'm going to maybe play it in a little more difficult way, but I can keep the note on the same string, right? And so that maintains the sonority of the line of the phrase. And so it forces me to think so hard sometimes my brain hurts, but I love it. I absolutely love it. It's great. The music is so glorious. Now, is there did you find, I mean, there's a total of six of these things, and like I said, the first one is this glorious thing, and then this the second one's kind of a doom and gloom kind of thing. Is there an overall arc to this, to the collection? Did you find?
It's a good question. There are definitely a lot of people who think so. I don't know where this idea came from, but it's one I encountered with a teacher of mine when I first studied the cello suites, that they thought of the six suites as being like stages in a person's life. So from that point of view, the first suite would be innocent and sort of natural. On the cello or on the viola, it emphasizes a lot of the open strings because it's in G major. So we have open strings on G, D, A, for
Right.
example. And then by the time you get to the later suites, so like suite number five is in C minor, it's very dark. It's written for scordatura, which means you tune the top string down one step, which makes the instrument ring in a different way, in a deeper way. And then the sixth suite is in D major, very bright key. And Bach actually wrote that for a five-string cello. So his cello is usually tuned C, G, D, A. And then they would have a top E string, which sort of brightens the instrument and opens up a certain range of virtuosity. And it feels like a kind of a pinnacle. So that's definitely one way to think of it. Whether that was how Bach conceived of it, that's difficult to answer. We know for sure Bach often approached these collections in a kind of encyclopedic way. So the idea might be a cellist who could play all six of these pieces would have mastered sort of everything that's possible on the instrument, could be one way to think of it.
Gotcha. Okay, I know that he was a very, very, very religious person, and so I mean, it's been suggested that a lot of his secular work was really not was also secretly sacred.
And there are folks who think of the six suites in those terms too, who use Christian metaphors for what the different pieces represent. So that's definitely possible. It's hard to say. I mean, certainly Bach was very deeply religious, and a lot of his manuscripts he wrote, and when he finished them, SDG, meaning Soli Deo Gloria, only to God glory. There are also scholars who would sound a word of caution about reading every piece that Bach ever composed as deeply religious. So, a piece like the Coffee Cantata, let's say, is probably not really a religious piece. Let's say this was a period of Bach's lifetime where he was not at all writing church music because his employer was Calvinist. So he wasn't church music was not needed during these years that he spent in Köthen when he composed this piece. But definitely possible to read these pieces in lots of different ways.
I think as an interpreter, if you don't know, what is your opinion of sort of imposing your own opinion on them then? Would you play them that way as
Right.
with some sort of an arc, or would you just play them as a encyclopedic, to use your word?
So first of all, I have never played all six suites in one concert, although many people have played them
Right.
that way. Many recordings that come out these days are organized that way.
Correct.
So it does raise this question you're asking about feeling all six in an arc. I don't really have my own opinion on that since that's not something I've ever done. I think these pieces are rich enough that there's many ways to experience them. I also think as a performer, we should be free to use our imagination however we wish. I'd be cautious ever to tell a listener or to tell a performer how they should feel or what they should be thinking about. I guess as an author, I do try to be a little restrained in my own opinion. So when I write the book, I try to say, well, there's a tradition of people hearing it this way, but what would we know that comes from Bach? It will be difficult to say that this was Bach's intended hearing, whatever that might be. But the composer doesn't own the music. The music belongs to all of us. So I think we're free to use our imagination and to connect with it in ways that feel meaningful to us and to our listeners.
When I was teaching the guitar majors at college, One of the things that I would tell them, and actually all my students, even if they were playing, simpler pieces, I would tell them that when I listen to a piece of music, I should be listening not only to the composer and the composer's thoughts, but I should be listening to the performer. And so there should be this third personality that emerges from the two. I'd kind of try to give them permission to use their own imaginations and allow their own personalities, and not necessarily impose, but allow their own personalities to come through. So you're okay with that.
I think there's many ways to make music, and I hate to. I mean, the
Yeah.
thing is, if I say I'm going to try to really focus on what I think Bach meant, what we forget is what I think Bach meant is also something I've somehow invented, or I've read what someone said that they think. So it's really not ultimately possible to, to put this another way, to answer more directly. I think a lot of listeners respond to a performance that feels to them authentic to the person who's playing, whatever that might mean. I mean, you can be authentic in the sense of I want to learn about what music might have sounded like in Bach's lifetime. That's something that I do. I play on historical instruments as well as modern. But I also enjoy performances like Pablo Casals that probably sound very different from how the cello could have been played in Bach's lifetime. I'm
So,
glad I don't need to choose one way of
oh
playing.
yeah, there. I applaud that right there.
Yeah.
Yeah. So now it's solo stuff, but I know I would bring some sort of a chamber music approach to interpretation. Is that something that you would advocate?
Yeah, there are movements where I play a melody, but I also play a bass line and there's some harmony notes. So in my own playing, in my own teaching, I often will practice or have my student practice. Okay, well, which notes are in that bass line? If you were just the bass line player, how would you shape that bass line? Maybe I, as the teacher, can play the melody while they play the bass line, and then we switch. And then when I play the whole piece, my task is to somehow be all of those people. Even though I'm just one instrument. So
Right.
for sure, I think that's a challenge that this music asks of us.
So it is absolutely glorious. So what's next, Professor? What you got on the horizon?
What's next? Well, now that I've written this book, I'm hoping to have some opportunities to talk to some audiences about it,
Sure.
to try to get some of these ideas out into the ether a little bit more. And maybe to collaborate with some people who play these pieces. One thing I discovered a lot in doing my research, you were just talking a moment ago about choices you make with a fingering. Do you go over to another string or do you go up on the same string? So I've been spending some time with editions of the cello suites that were made in the 19th century. So when musicians first started to play these pieces in concerts, that's mostly around the 1860s and later. We don't have recordings of these musicians, but
Of
we
course.
do have their editions with their fingerings. So I thought it could be an interesting project, maybe to reconstruct some of these performances as closely as we can, to
Oh.
get a sense of what some of the first people to hear these pieces, what it actually might have sounded like. One edition that I looked at was by the cellist Friedrich Grützmacher. He was the principal cellist in the Leipzig Gewandhaus Orchestra and professor at the Leipzig Conservatory. He was probably the first to play a complete suite in public and to do it fairly often to rave reviews. He produced two editions of the suites. One is pretty close to what Bach wrote, but the other is almost totally recomposed. Souped up with chords added, with new virtuoso techniques added. Most scholars, when they look at this, they just scratch their heads and say, how could anybody have done this injustice to Bach's music? But, I read the reviews of these performances and they were rave reviews. And so I thought it could be interesting to work with a cellist to actually make a performance, make a recording that reconstructs what his playing might have sounded like so we can even just hear it. Whether you like it or not, it tells us something about the history of these pieces, how they might have been played. So that's one project that might be on the horizon.
I know that the 19th century practice, mid 19th century practice for classical music was certainly improvisation, which we don't see today. That put in the measure of a solos, particularly, would be to put in a cadenza in the middle of a sonata somewhere or something that would be improvised. And so, and it just some of the reading that I've done over the years has suggested that they could play pretty footloose with the written page quite a bit. I know that Segovia, was my personal guitar hero. When he, if you listen to his recording, which is his transcription of that prelude, he, I don't think he played any Bach suites in their entirety ever, but he did, of course, play that prelude. And if you listen to it, he puts notes in there that Bach didn't put in, and they sound nice, you know. But they're historically inaccurate. I mean, it's just, you know, it's not totally faithful to the score. And so then the question becomes, okay, am I a cover band or am I an artist? You know, and is there a balance in there somewhere? Do how much latitude do I think that I have?
Playing, I maybe it's the way I was educated. I tend to think pretty seriously about the score as it was composed, as best as I can tell. But there are some performers I really admire who have a much freer approach to think about what the text is. Or another way to put it is, do we think the composition ends and then performance starts, or do we think of it all maybe as one continuous process, and that in performing we're somehow completing a creative process that involves some liberties that the performer would have had access to. These are difficult questions, and we come down on them in different ways, depending on the repertoire, depending on our temperament, our approach.
Definitely topics for a lot of conversation over a lot of coffee.
For sure.
So, well, thank you, sir. Believe it or not, we're out of time.
Okay.
And boy, that went by in a hurry. And so I thank you so much for taking the time to come on. I really, really appreciate your time. And we'll let everybody know about the book, and hopefully it's a big success for you.
It's a real pleasure to meet you.
Thank you. Bye-bye. I want to thank Edward Klarman for taking the time from his very busy day to talk with me, and to thank you too for spending time with us. I'm still trying to grow this program, and admittedly, I really don't know what I'm doing. So if you have any ideas, suggestions, or criticisms that you think might help, please leave a comment or send an email to roger@rogerhumphrey.com. I would appreciate your input a lot. And in the meantime, check out some of the other episodes of Creative Conversations with Roger Humphrey.